This is the story of a princess. Of a princess whose destiny was to become a queen. London, April the 21st, 1926.
This is London. The King and Queen have received with great pleasure the news that the Duchess of York gave birth to a daughter this morning.
Granddaughter of the reigning monarch, King George V, daughter of his second son, the Duke of York, niece of the Prince of Wales, the heir apparent to the throne, who then could foresee that when the baby princess was baptized in the chapel of Buckingham Palace, the names given to her on that day would be used 26 years later to proclaim a queen?
The high and mighty princess, Elizabeth Alexandra Mary, is now, by the death of our late sovereign of happy memory, become Queen Elizabeth II. By the grace of God, Queen of this realm, and of all her other realms and territories, head of the Commonwealth, defender of the faith, to whom her lieges do acknowledge all faith and constant obedience with hearty and humble affection. Beseeching God, by whom kings and queens do reign, to bless the royal princess Elizabeth II with long and happy years to reign over us. Given at St. James's Palace this 6th day of February, in the year of our Lord, 1952. God save the Queen!
Queen Elizabeth II, like most of her subjects, has lived through moments of great joy and through moments of deep sorrow. But above all, hers has been a life of service and devotion in the highest tradition of the British royal family.
I declare before you all that my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service and the service of our great imperial family to which we all belong.
In these words, the future Queen made her solemn act of dedication. Princess Elizabeth was broadcasting on her 21st birthday to an empire which also had come of age, for it was in 1926 that the Imperial Conference in London decided that the British Dominions, which included Great Britain itself, should become autonomous communities within the British Empire, united by a common allegiance to the Crown and freely associated as members of the British Commonwealth of Nations. And in 1932, King George V gave his first Christmas Day broadcast to this great family of nations, as he himself described it.
Through one of the marvels of modern science, I am enabled this Christmas Day to speak to all my peoples throughout the empire. I take it as a good omen that wireless should have reached its present perfection at a time when the empire has been linked in closer union. For it offers us immense possibilities to make that union closer still. It may be that our future will lay upon us more than one stern test. Our past will have taught us how to meet it unshaken.
An empire united and a mother country recovering from the industrial unrest and economic crisis which had threatened the world. Speaking to a great audience in the Royal Albert Hall, the Prince of Wales, the heir to the throne, had pointed the way to recovery.
The message that I have tried to give you is a threefold one. First, for a fresh response to national service, for a greater spirit of unselfish and adventurous helpfulness in the midst of problems which our ablest men find difficult to unravel. The second point is that the opportunity for service is at our door, in our own village, in our own town. And my third and last point is this, that depression and apathy are the devil's own. They are not English, so away with them.
Meanwhile, at Royal Lodge, Windsor Great Park, Princess Elizabeth, now with a younger sister and devoted companion, Margaret Rose, had other things to occupy her mind. So far, her appearances in public had been rare, and then only on family occasions. And such an occasion was the marriage of her uncle, the Duke of Kent, to Princess Marina of Greece.
It is 11 o'clock. The bridesmaids are waiting inside the west door. They are in white with silver sashes, silver wreaths in their hair, carrying magnificent white roses. The two small bridesmaids, Princess Elizabeth and Lady Mary Cambridge, look like two little fairies in clouds of white tulle.
Six months later, in May 1935, Princess Elizabeth made her first appearance in processional pageantry when, with the royal family, she joined the nation in celebrating the silver jubilee of the reign of her grandparents, King George V and Queen Mary. After a ceremony of thanksgiving at St. Paul's Cathedral, the royal party drove back through cheering crowds to Buckingham Palace. Later that evening, His Majesty King George V spoke to his people.
Words cannot express my thoughts and feelings. I can only say to you, my very dear people, that the Queen and I thank you from the depth of our hearts for all the loyalty and, may I say, the love with which this day and always you have surrounded us. I dedicate myself anew to your service for the years that may still be given to me.
Of the occasion, the King wrote in his diary, "All the children looked so nice, but none prettier than Lilibet and Margaret." But the echoes of the Jubilee celebrations had scarcely faded before it became known that the King was again gravely ill. During his previous long illness in 1928, the companionship of his baby granddaughter did much to hasten his recovery. But this time it was not to be. On January the 20th, 1936, a BBC announcement prepared the nation for news that was inevitable.
This is London. Following bulletin was issued at 9:25. The King's life is moving peacefully towards its close.
Shortly after midnight, the King died, and a quarter of a century of devoted service had ended. It was Princess Elizabeth's first experience of family loss, and 8 days later, she saw her beloved Grandpapa England laid to rest with his forebears at Windsor.
The members of foreign royal families in their uniforms, King Haakon of Norway, King Christian of Denmark, King Boris of Bulgaria, King Leopold of Belgium, King Carol of Romania, and then alone, a state landau drawn by the Windsor Greys. Within is Her Majesty Queen Mary.
The death of a king and the proclamation of his successor, Edward VIII, civil war in Spain, the occupation of the Rhineland, mobilization of Mussolini's armies for the invasion of defenseless Abyssinia, 1935 and 1936. These were momentous years, culminating in an event which was to have a profound effect on the future of the 10-year-old Princess Elizabeth.
This is London. A quarter of an hour ago, the Prime Minister came to the bar of the House and handed to the Speaker A message from His Majesty the King. Here is the text of the message, which was read by the speaker. After long and anxious consideration, I have determined to renounce the throne, to which I succeeded on the death of my father. And I am now communicating this, my final and irrevocable decision.
The instrument of abdication, executed on the morning of the 10th of December 1936, brought the young princess into the direct line of succession. 5 months later, on May the 12th, 1937, she drove through cheering crowds in the royal procession to Westminster Abbey and saw the coronation of her parents, King George VI and Queen Elizabeth.
God save the King! God save the King! God save the King!
Amidst the ceremonial pomp and pageantry of this great occasion, there were the simple but never to be forgotten moments.
The King slowly, with measured tread, moves forward, walking firmly, passing towards the theatre, and in the Royal Gallery, Queen Mary turns towards him and watches him, and I think I see her smile. And only a few feet from their father, the little princesses look on intently. He's passing them now.
And then the great drive in state through cheering crowds lining the route from Westminster Abbey to Buckingham Palace. This was to be the last of the great state occasions of traditional pomp and pageantry for many years to come. For the year that followed was an anxious one. Austria annexed by Hitler's Reich, the mounting power of the Rome-Berlin axis, the growing threat to Czechoslovakia, the problem of the Sudetenland. September the 26th, 1938.
Das in Bezug auf das sudetendeutsche Problem meine Geduld jetzt zu Ende ist.
Hitler's patience was at an end, but Britain's Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, was still striving with other free nations to find a peaceful solution to the European problem. The following day, September the 27th, Mr. Chamberlain spoke to the nation.
I shall not give up the hope of a peaceful solution or abandon my efforts for peace as long as any chance for peace remains. I would not hesitate to pay even a third visit to Germany if I thought it would do any good. But at this moment, I see nothing further that I can usefully do in the way of mediation.
On the same day, Princess Elizabeth journeyed with her mother to Clydebank and saw the Queen launch the great Cunarder, the world's largest liner, Queen Elizabeth, a product of British brain and British brawn, designed to sail the peaceful sea lanes, but destined to play a vital part in war. The European crisis made it impossible for the King to see this great ship launched, but he sent a message to his people, which was read by the Queen.
I have, however, a message for you from the King. He bids the people of this country to be of good cheer, in spite of the dark clouds hanging over them, and indeed over the whole world. He knows well that, as ever before in critical times, they will keep cool heads and brave hearts. He knows, too, that they will place entire confidence in their leaders, who, under God's providence, are striving their utmost to find a just and peaceful solution of the grave problems which confront them.
3 days later, Mr. Chamberlain brought back from Munich a hope of peace in our time. But soon this hope was to give way to foreboding. The following spring, Czechoslovakia was occupied by the Wehrmacht, and Mussolini's troops invaded Albania. Despite the treachery of Hitler and Mussolini, Britain's optimism and her King's high sense of service to the Empire was reflected in the decision not to cancel the promised royal visit to Canada that summer. On May the 6th, 1939, the two princesses saw their parents depart. 4 months later, on September the 1st, 1939, Hitler launched his attack on Poland. From Great Britain, an ultimatum was sent to the German Chancellor, and plans for the evacuation of children from Britain's cities were put into force. On September the 3rd, Mr. Chamberlain announced that Hitler had not replied to his ultimatum and that Britain was at war with Germany.
We have a clear conscience. We have done all that any country could do to establish peace. But a situation in which no word given by Germany's ruler could be trusted, and no people or country could feel itself safe, had become intolerable. And now that we have resolved to finish it, I know that you will all play your part with calmness and courage.
Throughout most of the war, Princess Elizabeth lived at Windsor, not far from London, the Luftwaffe's favorite target. Many were the offers of asylum abroad, but the King and Queen had decided that they and their family should face the common danger. A year after the outbreak of war, the danger at home became a very real one. Norway, Denmark, and the Low Countries had been overrun. France had fallen, and what remained of the Allied armies turned defeat into victory by their epic retreat from Dunkirk. Hitler stood on Britain's doorstep, but a voice spoke defiance.
We shall fight on, unconquerable, until the curse of Hitler is lifted from the brows of men. We are sure that in the end, all will be well. What General Wagon has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin.
And in the skies over southern England, the few in their Hurricanes and Spitfires fought and defeated Goering's Luftwaffe.
Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few.
September 1940. The Battle of Britain had been won, and Mr. Churchill's tribute was to the men who had fought. On the 13th of October, 14-year-old Princess Elizabeth spoke for the children of Britain whose homes these few had defended.
I can truthfully say to you all that we children at home are full of cheerfulness and courage. We are trying to do all we can to help our gallant sailors, soldiers, and airmen. And we are trying, too, to bear our own share of the danger and sadness of war. We know, every one of us, that in the end, all will be well. For God will care for us and give us victory and peace. And when peace comes, remember, it will be for us, the children of today, to make the world of tomorrow a better and happier place. My sister is by my side, and we are both going to say good night to you. Come on, Margaret.
Good night, children.
Good night, and good luck to you all.
The failure of Hitler's invasion plans was followed by an attempt to cripple Britain's war production and to break the morale of her people. In the early stages, London bore the brunt of the attack. Months and years, Britain's cities, towns, and villages were to withstand the Nazi onslaught, first from Goering's bombers and later from the terror weapons of the V-1 and the V-2. Buckingham Palace was bombed 9 times, and Princess Elizabeth's childhood home in Piccadilly was wiped out. Britain can take it became more than a slogan, for the people stood firm. In Britain, encouraged by frequent visits from the King and Queen to their blitzed houses and factories, they were encouraged, too, by a voice from across the Atlantic.
We shall send you, in ever-increasing numbers, ships, planes,
tanks, guns. That is our purpose and our pledge.
Britain's answer was given by her wartime leader, Winston Churchill.
What is the answer that I shall give in your name to this great man, the thrice chosen head of a nation of 130 million? Here is the answer which I will give to President Roosevelt. Put your confidence in us. Give us your faith and your blessing. And under Providence, all will be well. We shall not fail or falter. We shall not weaken or tire. Neither the sudden shock of battle nor the long-drawn trials of vigilance and exertion will wear us down. Give us the tools, and we will finish the job.
Hitler's attack on Russia in June 1941 and Japan's treachery at Pearl Harbor 6 months later meant that Britain no longer stood alone. Ultimate victory was certain, but 3.5 years of blood, toil, tears, and sweat had still to be endured before the author of that phrase could announce to the British people that victory in Europe had been won.
We must now devote all our strength and resources to the completion of our tasks, both at home and abroad. Advance, Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom! God save the King!
All over Europe, the ceasefire had sounded, and from General Dwight D. Eisenhower, a future president of the United States of America, and the man who had led the Allied armies to victory in Europe, came this tribute.
As a United States officer, I deem it my right to pay tonight special tribute to my British comrades, from highest commanders to the newest private. They have earned the high respect, admiration, and friendship of all their Allied comrades. Speaking particularly, for 3 million Americans in this theater, I merely say, we don't like war, we never will like it. But so long as we had to fight this one, we thank our God, we had the men of the British Empire as partners.
By this time, Princess Elizabeth, now 19 years of age, was herself in uniform. As a second subaltern in the Auxiliary Territorial Service, she had been trained to drive and maintain field ambulances and other vehicles. But the second great day of victory arrived before her training could be put to the test on active service. Mr. Attlee's government was now in power, and on the 15th of August, 1945, the Prime Minister announced,
Japan has today surrendered. The last of our enemies is laid low.
That evening, His Majesty King George VI addressed the nation and empire. Like many of his subjects, the king had experienced personal bereavement. His youngest brother, the Duke of Kent, had been killed on active service with the RAF. Possibly he was thinking of this as he spoke.
Our sense of deliverance is overpowering. And with it all, we have a right to feel that we have done our duty. I ask you again, at this solemn hour, to remember all who have laid down their lives and all who have endured the loss of those they love.